It's 4:06 and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, in for Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up on Wisconsin Life, we'll talk about the ups and downs of winter in Wisconsin.
First, the state recently announced a new plan to protect pollinators here in Wisconsin, where more than 60% of bee colonies died off last year alone. With 35% of the world's food supply relying on pollinators, farmers and the state want to keep them around. So the Department of Agriculture, Trade and Consumer Protection came up with a plan that includes increasing roadside planting and home gardens that are more bee-friendly.
But critics are saying that plan won't do much if it doesn't tackle a group of pesticides that are thought to seriously affect pollinators. Here to tell us more is Bridget Bowden, a Mike Simonson Investigative Fellow for WPR and the Center for Investigative Journalism. Her new report on bees and pesticides is available now at WPR.org. Bridget, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, before we get into criticism of this new plan, just spell out what's at stake here. How badly affected have bees been lately by a variety of problems, and how crucial are they to agriculture?
Yeah, so if you'll think back to your middle school science class, you'll remember that plants need to be pollinated, right? And so one way they can be pollinated is through bees flying around, buzzing around, collecting the pollen, flying to another flower, and spreading the pollen that way. So a lot of our crops are pollinated that way. Crops like apples and cranberries, cherries, a lot of other fruits and vegetables. They're really important. Bees and other pollinators are. As far as economic impact, roughly translates to about $55 million of Wisconsin's economy.
And then we've seen big years of colony collapses, colony die-offs. How bad are things here in Wisconsin over the last handful of years?
Things are pretty bad right now. Like you said earlier, just last year, 60% of our honeybee colonies died off. And that's pretty high. It's one of the highest rates of all 50 states. Just for some context, beekeepers say that 15% loss a year is what you should be seeing, and we saw 60.
And I saw in a chart from the Center for Investigative Journalism, most years for the last handful of years, we've been above, in some cases, well above that 15% threshold.
Yeah, that's true.
So let's get into this criticism of the new plan. Now, there's a new pollinator plan. It does a bunch of things, a habitat preservation, that sort of thing. But critics are saying, no, you're missing a big thing. What's the main point of criticism?
There's a couple of main points, actually. So the first that's a little bit easier to explain is that the plan is voluntary. There are no mandates or pilot programs or anything that, is definitely going to happen. It's all suggestions on ways to help the bees. And there is a lot of great information in the pollinator plan, a lot of things that homeowners can do, but it is voluntary. And then the second big criticism would be that it doesn't challenge the use of a class of pesticides called neonicotinoids. Some people call them neonics for short. And it's been shown that these pesticides can have a pretty devastating effect on pollinators.
And we've seen the use of this kind of pesticide rise a lot over the last bunch of years here in Wisconsin and around the country, right?
We have. Actually, if you look at the map, which is on WPR.org and also on WisconsinWatch.org, you can see how the use of certain neonics has grown since they were first introduced, and especially in states like Iowa, Wisconsin, really the states that you consider your corn belt. It's stunning how much the use of these chemicals has grown.
Talking to Bridget Bowden from WPR News and the Center for Investigative Journalism, looking at bees here in Wisconsin. A state plan aims to help them preserve pollinators in the state. Criticism, though, that the plan is voluntary, as we were just hearing, and doesn't go far enough when it comes to pesticides. So in the thinking about the problems facing bees, I know there's still a lot of question marks. Neonicotinoids seen as part of the problem, not necessarily a whole thing. People are looking at a lot of different causes for the bee problems.
Right, that is true. Every scientist that I spoke with told me that although we know that these pesticides do have an effect on pollinators such as bees, we are not 100% sure that pesticides are the smoking gun. There are a lot of other things going on that affect bees, such as habitat loss. If there's nowhere for the bees to live and forage, then they're not going to thrive. There have also been pathogens that we've seen around the country that have had a pretty serious effect on pollinators as well. So it could be a combination of things.
So pretty good idea, though, that it's at least part of the problem, it sounds like. So what are environmental critics? You quoted some organic farmers. What are they hoping to see when it comes to neonicotinoid pesticide use?
I definitely think that there is a group of people that would like to see neonics outlawed entirely, as far as whether or not that is realistic. Right now, the EPA has sort of halted the approval of new neonics, and they're reconsidering the use of the ones that are already on the market. So what they're doing is the EPA is researching effects a little more in depth than any research we've seen so far.
Now, one objection I've seen from in your reporting, actually, is that, well, these neonicotinoids often are being used to replace older pesticides that have known bad effects on humans and other mammals. So pick your poison, in a sense.
Well, yeah, I think it's important to note that, you know, we do have to produce food. And in agriculture, it's very important to manage pests. And pesticides is one way that you can do that. And these neonics, when they were first introduced in the 1990s, showed to be very effective pesticides. They're mostly used as seed coatings. So they sort of coat the seed, and then as the plant grows, they become a systemic part of the plant. They have been shown to be less toxic to mammals and humans than older pesticides, but there were some unintended effects like those we've seen on pollinators.
And between the current status quo, where we've seen, as you mentioned, growing use of these pesticides over the last handful of years, and on the other end, banning them outright, are people looking for any kind of middle ground, limited use or more selective use, anything like that?
Yeah, definitely. People are talking about limiting which crops neonics are used on. But the problem at hand is that the crops that are using neonics most heavily are corn and soybeans. But those two crops do not need bees or other pollinators. They're wind pollinated. So there's sort of an issue of the crops that are using the neonics are not the ones that need the bees. But there's really no way to tell the bees, don't go into that field.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And from what we know in the research on the effect of these pesticides, what does this pesticide do to bees?
So, like I said, they're called neonicotinoids. Mm. So they actually act like nicotine in the bee's brain, or the pollinator's brain. I should say it's not just bees. It's also butterflies, native bees, bumblebees. So it acts like nicotine in the bee's brain. And at certain doses, it can be toxic, fatal for the bees. And at other doses, it can mess with their navigation system. So all sorts of different effects.
So is there any sense that, I mean, you mentioned the EPA stopping research on new neonicotinoids. Is there any sense that any regulator, state or federal, might be looking at somehow limiting their use?
Well, like I mentioned earlier, the main crops that use neonics are corn and soybeans. So those are the big crops. Those are the big cash crops. So I think as we move forward, we're going to see some tension between corn and soy and those smaller fruit and vegetable producers that do need the bees.
Now, when this plan, this state pollinator protection program was rolled out a while back, we talked to one of the state administrators in charge of it, and he's hoping a part of it is publicity, getting the word out for those voluntary practices you mentioned. Do we have any sense whether the word's getting out, whether people are maybe this spring going to be planting in the ways they're talking about, changing their practices, or is it too soon to tell?
Well, I hope so. Like I said, there's a lot of great information in the plan, a lot of great information about what bees do, what kind of plants bees like. If you're interested in planting a home garden or that kind of thing, the plan will definitely tell you what to do. So yeah, hopefully it will spread awareness, like you said.
Bridget, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
That was Bridget Bowden talking to us about the state's pollinator protection program and some of the challenges of restoring Wisconsin's bee and butterfly populations. It's time for today's Wisconsin Life with a look at winter here in the state, and we want to hear from you. Do you like spending winters in Wisconsin? What do you like or dislike about the long, often, maybe not this year so much, cold season. What tips do you have to keep busy and survive the cold and snow? Or maybe you just can't stand winter. You wish you could hibernate until spring. Call now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll be taking your calls in just a few minutes after we check in with Wisconsin Life. Winter is full of its ups and downs, both in our moods and in the temperatures. Helene Phelps reminds us what is so wonderful about these dips and swings.
In summertime, the terms dip and swing set a 17-foot canoe in motion, dodging boulders and down trees on riverways, or gliding into good fishing territory on inland lakes in Wisconsin's far north. In wintertime, it's the temperature that swings and dips wildly in waves and colors on the landscape and on the evening news. Arctic air masses are part of this season's waltz, blasting through Canadian provinces and on down through the Dakotas and Minnesota before it whooshes through my neck of the woods near Brule to continue its due course. When temperatures drop below the invisible below zero mark, it's a frosty reminder that we really do live in the north. Today begins the downward creep from yesterday's fresh snow and balmy 32-degree breezes. Now dropping to 11 degrees with a wind chill of minus 2, the new morning is gray and white. The day is growing older and colder. The neighborhood bird feeders beckon chickadees by the dozen, nuthatches too, and all manner of woodpeckers. They all take turns, but they are messy. Dropped seed is the siren call for wild turkeys lurking near. These funny-looking creatures actually run across the open when they see smaller breeds feeding. They are smart, it seems, and know when the frozen ground will offer speckles of sunflower and millet. This is winter entertainment at its best. But mostly, in northern Wisconsin, our neighbors are fur-covered and four-legged. The crisscross tracks of deer, herding and hiding out, keeping warm, protecting each other with their thermal overcoats. The squat bobcat that steps lightly so near the woodshed, but is never ever seen. The enormous porcupine balanced on the tip-top limb of the virgin white pine near the creek. He is likely on the lookout for spring. The coyotes and eagles circling land and air for a free lunch. All these and smaller critters too choose, like me, not to relocate when the season dips to cold and white. Wood stoves crackle and hiss, transforming last year's oak into soft gray ash. The aroma of chimney smoke fills us with dreams of green arching up out of snowbanks. April or May, it's anyone's guess when the first ephemerals will appear. But we are a patient bunch. In northern Wisconsin, we all bundle up and hunker down. We ski and snowshoe and hope the forest creatures are as snug and safe as hibernating humans. We measure our days in pea soup and pages turned, short walks and warming up during downy naps. And we wear fat socks.
How about you? What do you love or hate about winter? Call now at 800-642-1234. Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. It's a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more online at wisconsinlife.org.
So we just heard about one person's ups and downs of winter in Wisconsin, and we'd like to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you enjoy or maybe despise spending winters in our state? What do you do to stay busy during these frigid, long, dark months? Maybe there's something about winter that keeps you living here year after year. Give us a call now at 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we surveyed some of our colleagues here at WPR. We heard from Aubrey Ralph. He says, having grown up in Florida, snow has always had this magical hold on me. For me, I come alive in the winter. There's this stark beauty in a dark gray world turning to white in the first storm. He says, I don't ski or go snowshoeing or fly across lakes on ice boats. I just love winter because it makes me feel whole and helps erase the trauma inflicted by 24 brutal southern summers. Bit of a poet, Aubrey, and he loves his winter.
And our coworker Karina says, I appreciate how the freezing temperatures take care of fall allergies.
Oh, yeah.
Every year when that first cold snap sets in, I ask myself why I live here. Eventually, you get used to the cold and bundling up. It's amazing how 40 degrees feels cold in fall, but it feels so warm in the spring.
Let's bring in our callers now at 800-642-1234. Rick is with us in Racine. Rick, hi.
Good afternoon. Yes, I have to use a line that I stole from Big Top Chautauqua when I lived up in Bayfield. And the line is, the cold tends to keep out the riffraff.
So you are not riffraff, Rick. You like the cold.
Well, I enjoy the change of seasons. I think I'd get bored if everything was always the same. However, my one complaint is not so much the cold, it's the cloudiness. I did live in Colorado for a while, and what I noticed in Colorado is that even after a storm, whether it was summer or winter, the sun would come out, and it was almost like Mother Nature was saying, come on out and play. Even if it's, 20 below, it's still nice and sunny out.
That's great, Rick. And Judith, weren't you saying the other day you don't mind the cold,
exactly.
You don't mind the snow, but if it's just cold and dreary and overcast for a bunch of days, that's the part of
winter. The dreary and the gray and the cloudy really gets to me, especially when the days are short. I don't have a window in my office. I come in when it's kind of overcast and gray. I leave when it's dark and gray, and that gets to me.
Well,
but I love winter. I'm going on record. I love winter.
We'll put in order for fewer clouds in the winter.
Thank you.
Thanks, Rick. We'll go next to Mike in East Troy. Mike, hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. What do you got for us in the winter, Mike?
Oh, my son and I just love the lake fall, and we get all excited anticipating winter. We're both skiers. Now, we're downhill skiers, and we live just 10 minutes from a nice little resort in East Troy. And when they start making snow, we'll look at night to see when the lights are glowing in the sky, and we'll run out there to see all the snow guns blowing snow. We get really excited about that. It changes the way one looks at winter. Instead of going, oh man, snow to shovel, now you've got snow to play on, and it's just great fun. We've got a number of great little alpine resorts for downhill skiing in the area, and with the Kettle Moraine, we've got all sorts of Nordic tracks. I mean, it's kind of sad if you're grousing about winter in Wisconsin. There's so much to do. It's fun.
Love the enthusiasm, Mike. Thanks so much.
And I want to share something from our coworker Kirill, because I think she brings it into a different perspective. She says, I love our winters and wouldn't dream of living somewhere without four distinct seasons. Mm. So it's not just winter. It's the comparison to the other seasons. She says, big feathery snowflakes, hoarfrost mornings, cobalt snow shadows, the tingle of nose hairs on sub-zero mornings, sun dogs and ice halos, the creak and squeak of snowshoes, wood smoke welcoming me home.
Wow. Again, the poetic staff here at Wisconsin Public Radio. We'll go back to our callers as we talk about what we love or don't love about winter in Wisconsin. Chuck joins us next at 800-642-1234. Chuck is in Springstead. Chuck, hi.
Hi there. What I really love about Wisconsin and north, and actually the polar vortex, is really great is you can go to grocery store, buy a gallon of ice cream, throw it in the back of your truck, drive around with it for a month, and it's still good.
Now, wait a minute. In the last couple of days, you might have lost the ice cream.
You might want to check the trunk.
Yeah, I know. It's been kind of uncomfortable the last couple of days. But good cold weather, and you can't beat it. Outside ice cream locker.
Chuck, thanks a lot. Hopefully you ate the ice cream before last, was it Friday, when it hit 50 in a lot of parts of the state.
Well, Chuck, thanks for that. Let's go back to the phones, and Dick is in Eau Claire. Hi, Dick.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. What a great conversation. No, I love winter. I've loved it ever since I was a kid. I'm 74 years old, and doing a part-time job where I get out in a car and get out into the country, and there's nothing prettier than these big open fields that are snow covered, And some of the drifts that come along the side of the highway, they're sculptures like, well, ma'am can't, I don't think, can could copy them. They're just gorgeous.
Well, I think I agree, Dick. I love looking at a winter landscape, but I'm guessing there's some people that are out driving in the winter and are cursing the driving conditions. So that might count on both sides of our little tally here.
Better viewed from a house window than a car window. Thanks for that call. John is with us next in McFarland. John, hi.
Hi there.
What do you got, John?
I basically think the best thing about winter is getting the opportunity to go south. I don't mean Beloit.
So you're not a fan of being here in the winter?
Well, I'm not, because I have tried like all the sports, and I'm not a really young super snapper anymore. And it's just, there's nothing I really can do in winter that I enjoy. And sledding looks a little silly for me at my age. And so it just doesn't really, I just kind of wait for golf and other outdoor activities.
But it makes that trip south a lot, something you can look forward to.
Yeah,
huh?
If I can take my golf clubs along. Of course, one of the challenges of going south in the middle of the winter is being able to afford to or having time to do it. But
John, thanks.
That would be the best for me, yeah.
John, thanks a lot. Mark that calendar. Golf is not too far away here in Wisconsin.
Well, and I know that for a lot of people, what gets them through winter is planning their gardens. Seed catalogs start showing up in January, and I know our technical director, Michelle Good, is in the camp sharpening up those tools, drawing things on paper grids, knowing what's going to come up.
I'm already planning on falling behind in my gardening, too.
I'm already behind.
It only takes me a couple weeks, yeah, before we're overwhelmed with weeds.
Well, thanks for your calls, and you can keep sharing the pros and cons of winter on the Central Time Facebook page.
With lifetime appointments, many U.S. Supreme Court justices spend the last several decades of their lives on the highest court in the land. Justice Antonin Scalia recently passed away after serving for almost 30 years.
But voices from all over the political spectrum are calling for a change to the system. They say that a limited term would provide turnover on the court that would be good for the judicial system and the nation as a whole.
Joining us now to talk about the issue is Gabe Roth. He's the executive director of the group Fix the Court. Gabe, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, make the basic case. Why get rid of these lifetime appointments and have some shorter term? People throw around 18 years pretty often.
Sure. So, as you know, the justices of the Supreme Court have immense power to affect our lives. Their decisions on who can vote, who can marry, where we can pray, and what freedoms we enjoy, they're binding on us all. They're irreversible. These are unaccountable individuals who are serving 30, 35, sometimes upwards of 40 years on the court, and given the fact that, you know, with paralysis in Congress and challenges, gridlock between the legislative and executive branches, the Supreme Court has become so powerful, and we don't believe that any individual should hold power for that long. So the idea that regular terms, fixed terms, be implemented is something that we feel is more becoming of a modern democracy such as ours.
So when was the lifetime appointment for Supreme Court justices put into place?
So it was put into place in the U.S. Constitution. Article 3 says that federal judges should serve for a term of good behavior, which essentially means that they would serve for life. But the thing is that when the Constitution was written, life expectancy was a lot shorter. And also when the Constitution was written, the court had less power. There was judicial review hadn't been established and wouldn't be established for another couple decades after it was written. So over time, the court has become more powerful. It has become kind of the quintessential American legalistic body with such gridlock in the other branches. And as such, and it's sort of come to a head in the last couple of years, we believe that there should be some movement to make it less feudal and more democratic.
Some people say, you know, what you're pointing out as a bug in the system, a problem with the system, is actually a benefit, because with this lifetime appointment, the justice doesn't need to worry about the politics outside of the courtroom. They don't need to worry about their post-judicial career. They can just devote all their time and attention to justicing, and that's a good thing. Do you think there's any merit to thinking that way?
Well, possibly, but I think, you know, I like looking at what's actually happened for the individuals who are former Supreme Court justices, right? So you have Sandra Day O'Connor, who started her own nonprofit organization that's trying to bring civics into the classroom. She stepped down after about 25 years and actually still hears cases from time to time on the Ninth Circuit, which is a federal circuit out by her in Arizona. Justice Souter does similar things up in New Hampshire, working on a federal circuit from time to time. in New England. And then John Paul Stevens goes around the country, writes books, gives speeches. You know, if lifetime tenure was changed at the Supreme Court, those individuals, the new justices, because this would have to be prospective, they still could be federal judges for life. You know, they still could work on lower courts. But the fact that they would be at the high court, the highest court in the land, for upwards of 25, 35 years, is something that we think should be fixed, especially given Justice Scalia's passing and the fact that, you know, the country has essentially been thrown into constitutional chaos because of a very predictable, you know, actuarially predictable death of a 79-year-old man.
We're talking with Gabe Roth. He's executive director of the group Fix the Courts. We're talking about proposals to put a term limit on the justices on the U.S. Supreme Court. And Gabe, the number that is floated as a possible fixed term for justices is 18 years. Why that number?
I think it's, well, just on the face, it's long enough that the justices who serve an 18-year term would be able to have, you know, get the ropes, understand what, how the court operates, get a number of high-profile decisions written by them under their belts, and then, but not stay so long as to be seemingly undemocratic. Also, with nine justices, the idea that there would be turnover in a way such that every other year there would be a new justice appointed to the court, so a nomination every 2 years. 2 times 9 is 18. So that sort of works out nicely in a number of different ways.
As you mentioned, Gabe, this is in the Constitution. And as you mentioned, we're in divided partisan times. So given both those facts, do you think people would be able to get together and agree enough to go to the effort of changing the Constitution, of amending the Constitution to make this change?
Well, I think it can be done legislatively. I think you can define the term that's written in the Constitution as, okay, so they're on the federal bench for life, but they're not at the Supreme Court for life. They're only at the Supreme Court for 18 years of that time. And you know, what we have now is justices that are gaming their tenures. They're waiting for a like-minded president to sit in the Oval Office until they step down. Presidents are incentivized to nominate people in their 40s who may not have as much experience as some of the current federal judges who are in lower courts, who are in their late 50s, early 60s. So there are a lot of perverse incentives that are in play when you think about Supreme Court nominations when you have life tenure, right? The fact that so many justices on the court were nominated during Reagan's time, the last justice to step down in 2010 was nominated by Gerald Ford. I mean, these presidents are having influence on the court long beyond the time that they're in their office and long beyond the time that they're on this earth. And in order to make the court reflect the modern democracy that America is, and frankly, to reflect the rest of the Western world. The U.S. is the only place that has lifetime tenure for its highest judges. Most places in the world either have between a 9 and 18-year term or mandatory retirement ages, which is another issue that gets talked about. So I think legislatively we could make it so that the justices serve for life as federal judges, but only 18 years of which would be served at the Supreme Court.
So if that was already the rule today, which of the current justices would have already been retired from the Supreme Court?
So Scalia, he would have had to retire in 04 under Bush's tenure. Same thing with Anthony Kennedy. He would have left in 06 after 18 years. And then Justice Thomas, he's also been on the court longer than 18 years. And then Justices Breyer and Ginsburg, both Clinton appointees, they would have been compelled to retire towards the end of Obama's first term. So it would be about half the court would fall under that rubric.
So since the 80s and the era of Ronald Reagan, Republican president, and a Democratic Congress, these Supreme Court appointments have turned into epic battles a lot of the time. Do you think this would take some of the heat off of those, this notion that, okay, this isn't going to be 20, 30, maybe 40 years. This is 18 years. It would make these, you know, the confirmation process a little easier?
Exactly. If there is a confirmation process that we know that is regular every other summer, that would take the temperature down by a lot, I think. That's also why Fix the Court wants the current process to move forward, that whoever is nominated, that, you know, he or she is given a fair shot, but tied to that is a pledge from that nominee. If the Congress can't make a legislative fix to life tenure, that nominee we're going to push hard to get that nominee to pledge to serve only 18 years, which we think would be a start in the right direction. So confirm and curb, so to speak.
We're talking with Gabe Roth of Fix the Court about proposals to eliminate lifetime appointments to the U.S. Supreme Court and to replace it with a term of 18 years.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you like this idea? Do you support limiting how long justices can serve on the U.S. Supreme Court? Why? Why not? If you do, do you think 18 years is a good number, or is that still too long or not quite long enough? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We continue our conversation now with Gabe Roth from the group Fix the Court about proposals to change Supreme Court nominations 10 years from life appointments to limited terms.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What do you think of changing appointments to the U.S. Supreme Court to a term of, say, 18 years? Would anything about the court change, including who gets nominated and how easy the confirmation is? Would you support changing the U.S. Constitution to make this happen? Why? Or why not? Again, call in at 800-642-1234. You can also send us an email at talk@WPR.org. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page or tweet us at Central Time WPR.
And we'll go to our callers now. Charlie is on the line in Milwaukee. Charlie, hi.
Hi, thanks so much for taking my call. My biggest concern for limiting the terms to, say, 18 years, wouldn't that then make precedent less important? And if you knew that there was always going to be a turnover of the justices, wouldn't they then say they'd almost be auditioning for a spot every couple years? And as such, they would be changing things such as precedent and make things a little more confusing than it is now.
Charlie, thanks for that call. And Gabe, that's what some people say the Supreme Court is supposed to be, the sort of stabilizer in our government, make it hard to make rapid changes. If it's changing more often, maybe that's a little less of a stabilizing influence in American politics.
Well, I mean, I think you're seeing that happen already when Clarence Thomas came in for Thurgood Marshall or Sam Alito came in for Justice O'Connor. There was sort of this jurisprudential change on various different cases when you think about campaign finance being the one that comes to mind at first. But, you know, it is going to be fairly stable. Eight mm-hmm. of the nine justices are going to be together for, you know, when there's a new one, the next new one, they will have already been together for 16 years. So it's not like this is happening. And the changing one justice at a time is, you know, there could be some sort of change. But the idea is also that you find individuals who, you know, aren't the 45-year-old party activist, as has been found in the last couple of decades, but is maybe somewhat of a more seasoned individual, more moderate, more able to understand their role and not have this partisan outlook as so many of the younger justices on both sides of the aisle, frankly, have.
Let's go back to the phones, and Karen in Franklin is up. Hi, Karen.
Hi. I think this is an interesting idea. What I'm wondering about is what happens if a justice were to die during their 18-year term or to retire, to leave the job.
So, Karen, are you asking if someone would come on with a brand new 18-year term, or would they finish out that term, whatever the leftover years are?
Well, actually, either one. What happens if someone leaves before their 18 years is over? They're appointed, and they've got an 18-year term, sure. And they die after 10.
Great. Thanks for that call. So, Gabe, obviously this is all theoretical or
sure,
hypothetical right now, but I'm guessing this is something that you and your colleagues have
it
thought
is.
About.
It is. And our recommendation would be that someone be appointed to finish that term. So if it's an 18-year term, an individual passes away or resigns in year 10, then a new individual would be appointed to serve years 11 through 18. So similar to what you would have if someone passed away in certain state legislatures or even Congress. You'd fill out, there'd be an appointment to fill out the term, and then once that 18th year is reached, a new 18-year term would start. So in other words, it would keep to a similar schedule.
Karen, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234 as we talk to Gabe Roth from Fix the Court. Talk about the idea of ending the lifetime tenure of Supreme Court justices, replacing it with a fixed term, maybe 18 years. We'll go back to our callers. Mark is on the line in Two Rivers. Mark, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What do you think?
I think the logic that is being used is based on some faulty assumptions. First of all, the word constitutional chaos was used. I don't believe that there's a constitutional chaos going on right now. There's a lot of bickering going on with bipartisan politics. But that's not the same as constitutional chaos. And the second thing I wanted to point out is it was also mentioned about bringing a more democratic form to the bench. Well, the purpose of the Supreme Court isn't democratic reform. The purpose of the bench is justice and constitutionality of law, not democratic reform. And so I think there's two fundamental flaws in the logic that's being proposed. I don't really care one way or the other. Well, I do care, but I'm a I'm against making a change, but I just wanted to point out what I view as problems with the logic.
Mark, thanks for the call. So the Supreme Court problem, he's saying, isn't causing the partisan bickering. Partisan bickering is there, and it'll affect the Supreme Court and everything else, he's saying, Gabe.
Sure. I mean, I think what I was referring to in the former was that there are a number of issues that we're guessing are going to be decided 4-4, whether it be the whole women's health case on abortion or the DAPA and DACA case on undocumented immigrants or some voting rights case. So essentially you're going to have all these cases that are going to probably end up 4-4, be held over for a year. And when you have a case that's 4-4, you know, the rules are just sort of cockamamie. So in this part of the country with under this federal judge, they're one way, and in this part of the country and another federal judge, they're another way. So that's unbecoming of our democracy. We shouldn't have different rules for different states, and that's why a Supreme Court exists and has an odd number of justices. The other thing is, because the Supreme Court has become so powerful, if you thought 20, 30 years ago that issues like marriage and voting rights and campaign finance were going to be decided by 9 unelected judges and not by the Congress and the executive branch, people would have told you that you're crazy. The court has got this outsized amount of power in the last few years, and justices are serving longer and longer, twice nowadays than they were even 50 years ago on average. And in order to sort of rein in the power and put them back into the Article 3 box that they were originally construed in behind the Congress and the executive, we think that some institutional reforms are necessary, and you know, ending life tenure is definitely one of the top ones.
So, Gabe, is there support across the political spectrum for reforming of the court in terms of how long justices serve? Is anyone advocating strongly to keep it as it is?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked. Yes, we've actually done some polling, and it's about 2/3 of the country supports this. Individuals from both sides of the aisle, presidential candidates on the right, liberal law deans on the left, members of Congress, law professors, legal scholars, historians. It really has editorial boards. The Washington Post editorial board today just wrote about how life tenure should be reconsidered. So it's really been interesting studying this issue just to see how there is bipartisan support, which I think is very important. And I don't really think either party would necessarily gain from this proposal. I just think the American people would gain the knowledge of when a term would end and not have this question that's going to be up in the air, who will be the 9th justice for potentially up, you know, 12, 13 months is what we're hearing now. So so I think that would just add a little bit more calm to the body politic.
All right. So this issue is front and center now. What are you doing at Fix the Court to try to get that support in the public, the support from some in Congress to turn into action, to turn into doing something?
So you'll be seeing some things from us in the next couple of days. So definitely follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Fix the Court, and facebook.com/fixthecourt, and our website fixthecourt.com. But we're going to be putting together a proposal to get the next potential nominee through on the condition that they pledge to serve 18 years, and then also just raising this in the public sphere. Whether it's I was out in Iowa a few weeks ago and try to raise this on the campaign trail, and I'll be going to D.C. next week to raise this with lawmakers and members of the media there. So we're going to definitely keep the pressure on the court. And the other thing is, too, with this, something that I don't think has really been brought up is that this ongoing vacancy really tarnishes the legacy of John Roberts. John Roberts cares about the institution of the Supreme Court as Chief Justice, and all these upcoming 4-4 decisions and all this uncertainty doesn't do him any favors as the top legal official in the country. And I think it really behooves him to step in and push for a confirmation of a 9th justice. And we're going to be doing what we can to advocate for that perspective as well.
Gabe, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Of course. Thank you guys so much.
That was Gabe Roth. He's executive director of the group Fix the Court, which advocates for changing the terms that U.S. Supreme Court justices serve from lifetime, the current situation, to 18 years. You can keep the conversation going by posting your thoughts on the Central Time Facebook page.